Greetings to you all. I'm Gregory Donovan. I'm one of the senior editors at Blackbird, an online journal of literature and the arts. The other senior editor, Mary Flynn, is the person who originally had the idea for this event to honor Carol Houck Smith. We've gathered on this occasion in the metropolis, which is the historic home place of so much activity that has been central in American publishing, to honor an editor who has for many years provided a crucial service to us all by shepherding into being many of the works of fiction, poetry, and nonfiction which we have most enjoyed and ultimately treasured. Carol Houck Smith has done so with generosity and warmth, matched by an incisive and demanding intelligence, as well as unswerving good taste and judgment. Today's event will essentially be a reading by a sampling of the remarkable writers who have had the pleasure of having Carol Houck Smith as their editor at Norton. The people who will participate today are in the order that they'll be reading: Stephen Dunn, Beth Ann Fennelly, A. Van Jordan, Gerald Stern, and Ellen Bryant Voigt. And that will be followed by some comments from Carol herself. It is the purpose of great writing and of great editing to seek ways to defeat time, and now that's what we'll allow them to do for us. Thank you for coming.
Hi. I'm going to start with a poem that I dedicated to Carol. It's from my last book called Signs, and then I'll make a few comments afterwards. Signs. Earlier, a slow child in the vicinity of a slow children's sign, a boy just taking his time, his book bag weighing him down, and now driving past caution falling rock zone, an actual fallen rock right in the middle of the interstate. I call 9/11, report it, the danger, one loose rock suggesting many, some hilltop family of them finally about to become unglued. I say the signs have started to come true and laugh, but the operator is serious, only wants to know where and who. I give her the hard facts, the everything she wants. I'm a good citizen today. Soon I'll even stop at stop. Then at red, stop again, always careful about my braveries. Only late at night, nobody around, have I gunned it, gone right on through, felt the outlaw in me stir, smiled that inward smile. Truth is, I'd be happy in this world to be quietly significant like a good editor. I'd like to improve slow children, for example, by putting in that comma where it belongs. I'm almost home. The increase in Jesus bumper stickers have been telling me so. At Finzel, near Little Savage, in big letters at the end of a driveway, beware dog. And there he is, the beware dog, halfway between the house and the road, sleeping or waiting, I'll never know. That poem, of course, was meant to honor Carol and to point to the quiet significance of a good editor, though those of you who know Carol know that there are better words than quiet to describe her significance. Judicious, perhaps. The fact is that for all her charm and genuine good cheer, she has a steely side as well, which helps her make her the editor she is. She employs the word no very well, and she has a gifted I don't think so that's often followed by a laugh and an explanation. If we disagreed about whether a certain poem should be included in or excluded from my manuscript, I learned that if I insisted on my position three times, she was likely to yield. Twice wasn't enough. If the issue had to do with organization or with a comma, she would feel a greater sense of editorial righteousness and was more likely to hold her ground. But most importantly, she has always known when not to edit. One has to be a great editor to know when not to edit. I suspect that the beware dog in my poem was there because of Carol's love of dogs. The poem is dedicated to her, and I wanted to please her, so I invented a dog. Perhaps the only creatures that Carol loves more than dogs are men. I knew from the first time I met her that here was a woman who truly liked men, especially those of us who are pretty good dogs. She likes women too, don't get me wrong, but her step has always quickened a little in the presence of certain men. As she often says, I was her first poet. Before that, one can only imagine the relative dreariness of her life among those among those who traffic only in prose. With me, she discovered there could be some happy ways for a book not to make much money. Once the ice was broken, she started to accumulate poets like the ones here today. And I'll never forget that she offered Stanley Kunitz a 3-book contract when he was 91. That's great editing. We met at a writer's conference in Utah in 1987, and things evolved from there. Cautiously at first, I had a first refusal clause in my contract with another publisher. The rest is sweet history. Carol and I have done 9 books together, and a 10th is in the works. That seems extraordinary. I can't tell you how important it's been for me to have her in my life over these last 20 years as both editor and friend. Well, I can and have, and I'll say it to you how lucky I am to have you.
Hi, I'm Beth Ann Fennelly, and I'm so happy to be here today. I was thinking of various stories I could tell you about what a great editor Carol is and different poems she's helped me with or ordering of different books, and I decided I couldn't decide among them. I'd tell you 2 stories that have nothing to do with poetry, but I think that they'll illustrate what it means to have this unique mind that can take a thing and make it better and have this perfect kind of taste that allows the essence of something to come to the surface. The first story takes place at Breadloaf when I was there as a fellow several years ago. I was so happy that Carol was there too, and we were at a party and all these writers were there, and I was so proud that she was my editor. And as evening wore on, she decided she'd go back to her room, and I asked her if I could walk her back. So I was walking her back and we saw a fox trotting across the road, and it was the first fox I'd ever seen. That's kind of an aside, but seemed part of the magic of the moment. And I got her back to her room, and I was just overcome with this feeling of gratitude and admiration for her. And I saw a bottle of perfume she had on her counter, and I just burst out and I said, "That's your perfume? I'm gonna wear that perfume. I wanna wear that perfume. I wanna smell like you." And she looked at me and she said, "No, Beth Ann, that's not right for you. You're too nocturnal." I thought it was so great because, you know, the perfume is Narcissus and it's really a lovely perfume, but it's sweet and I'm not very sweet. And she knew that instinctively, even editing the perfume. So flash forward, you know, like 8 years, this took place about 2-3 months ago. I met Carol at her office and we decided we'd have lunch and we'd walk over to the Iroquois Hotel right around here and have lunch in Triumph. And when we got there, the hostess said, "Oh, Miss Smith, I'm so happy to see you. Please come over here and sit at your table." And then the very distinguished, handsome maitre d' came over. "Oh, Miss Smith, I'll get you your usual. I'm so happy to have you here. Please, anything you want." And on, everyone from the restaurant came over to pay fee since. I said, "Wow, Carol, you must really eat her a lot." She said, "No, not all that much." And I said, "Well, how do they know you that well?" And she said, "Well, when they first opened, I came in and their menu was riddled with typos." So I corrected their grammar and gave it back to them. And what I loved about that is they were charmed by her. Any one of us in this room would have done it and made enemies. And people would be spitting in our soup. Her, they love. She corrected all their comma errors. No comma splices in the Triumph restaurant now. So you can go there and eat and not be annoyed. I'm going to read one poem before I sit down, and this poem is from a new book, Unmentionables, that's coming out in April, and it was such an honor for me to be able to dedicate this book to Carol. It's our 3rd book together, and I've just loved working with you. It's been amazing. I'm from Illinois, although I live in Oxford, Mississippi now, and this poem is about something that we sometimes did growing up there. Cow tipping. I think I did it 3-4 times at least. Sneak out, ride with some boys in a truck to a farm, hop the fence with our flashlights and cores, and crash through grass where the small frogs fled the machetes of our feet, to where the Holsteins clustered, slumbered, grass, breath, milk-eyed, high as my shoulder, weighing a ton and worth a grand, they'd topple with a single bracing shove. The yoke of their shoulders thundered the ground, and we'd feel it through our feet as we ran, whooping, me nearly wetting my pants with adrenaline and fear. Those cows could toss me like a sack of trash, break my bones like balsa, though mostly what they did was roll to their stomachs, shake their stupid heads, unfold their forelegs, heave-ho to their feet. By then, we'd be racing home so fast I'd slam against the door frame, turn up the Springsteen, me on some guy's knees, grass slick, dew etched, another pair of white kids ruined. Check me out, puffing Kurt's menthol Marlboro, although I didn't smoke. Cough, cough. I could end this by saying how I ran with the boys and the bulls, and no one ever harmed me. I was a virgin then, stayed that way for years, though I wore Victoria's Secret beneath my uniform skirt. And no one ever harmed me. But I'm lifting off in a plane which clears a field of cows, the meek, long-suffering cows. And from this heightened window, I can't understand why I can't understand why whole countries hate our country. Because of our bemused affection for our youthful cruelties, because the smug postprandial of nostalgia coats the tongue. Somehow, despite the planes clearing fields of cows and flying into buildings full of red-blooded Americans, it's still so hard to accept that people who've never seen me would like to see me dead, and you as well, our fat babies. Our spoiled dogs. And I, a girl at 32, who likes to think she was a rebel, who lifts like a faceted crystal this tender recollection every few years to the bright window of her consciousness, or lobs it into a party for a laugh. Cow tipping? I've done that. Who brags? Isn't it a brag? That no harm ever came to her? What would they make of me, the terrorists, and terrified? Wouldn't they agree I've got it coming?
Last night, I caught the replay of the presidential Democratic, the presidential debates to me. And the last question that Wolf Blitzer asked Barack and Hillary was, he mentioned that for the audience, it seemed like that would be the dream ticket, the two of them. Asked if there was a possibility that they would work together if it came down to it. And Obama went through an explanation that was very political, but smart, of explaining how he wanted a cabinet that was not just working with him, but that was also willing to tell him no. And for me, that's how it's been working with Carol. I've had the pleasure of being surprised at times at the things that she's liked in my work, and also surprised at the things that she didn't like. But there haven't been many poems that she's asked me to take out of collections or anything like that, but just lines here and there. And part of the pleasure of working with her is that she's a very understated genius. And I don't say that lightly. I mean that she's also not just intellectual and generous, but she's also very funny and laid back in the way that she works with her writers. When I first came to Norton, I first got the phone call from Carol, I was sitting in my office at work, and I had just gotten an offer from another press to take the book, a smaller press. And I was not a winner of a contest, but the press liked it enough. They said they'd still publish it even though I didn't win. And when she called, I explained this to her. And she just paused for a second. She says, well, you know, we want the book. And I said, okay, well, you know, that says it all. But it was one of those things that, you know, when I thought about it, having worked with another press that I really enjoyed working with before, I realized over time that the thing that has made this special for me being with Norton hasn't been going from a smaller press to a larger press, but going to a seasoned editor in another press. And it's made all the difference for me working with you, so thank you. I'm going to read a poem from Magnolia, and this is in the voice of Richard Pryor. It has a epigraph from the Book of the Samurai. It is spiritless to think you cannot attain to that which you have seen and heard the masters attain. The masters are men, you are also a man. This is the night Richard Pryor met Mudbone. The moon hung orange as any sun just before it faces evening, like a flaming breast in the sky, calling my name. And I walked out under it and rubbed the moonlight all over my face and hands the way old folks used to do with sunlight on Wednesdays, because back in those times, the hard times, harder than any of this shit we're faced with today, they said the only time the sun came out was on Wednesdays if you were lucky, and a boy had to get his ass up early just to catch that. Well, it was a day like that that I'm about to tell you about, a day when all I could see were the mismatched symbols on the slot machine of my life. Surprisingly, this isn't a story about a woman. All my relationships with women were one long-legged story in high heels. But I'm not even trying to get to sex here for once. What I'm trying to say is when your foot brushes a woman's toes under the sheets, when you feel her breath on the back of your neck, turning your spine into a tall building, when your eyes meet hers while making love, you know you're looking at the truth. The truth is what I found whenever I thought life could prove better than the craps game I was born into. Oh, that's always just a roll of the dice. Like that time in Vegas when I walked out on stage, half high, half drunk, in 68, and there sat Dean Martin in the front row, drink in one hand, and a half-burned-out cigarette in his other cufflinked hand. And I looked at his seal-hide hair and his wax figure of a face, and the rest of the audience went out of focus. All the voices were put on mute. All I could hear was Dino stirring the ice in his drink, and I asked myself, what the fuck am I doing here? My skinny black ass from Peoria, Illinois. I walked out on stage and a switch flipped off inside my head. The room went white. My agent told me like in the movies, man, told me on the phone, real chill like, he said, I'd never work in this life again. But then I realized it wasn't neon marquees, gangsters, or headline acts I was afraid of. It was me. I spent years imitating Bill Cosby, telling jokes that fit me like a suit two sizes too big. I struck a sad figure on stage, even when I was good. Don Rickles came up to me once and said, what a great show. It's amazing how much you sound like Cosby. And then I wondered if everyone else could tell I had climbed inside his skin and zipped him up. I wondered who else would unzip my monologue and find me there trembling. After Vegas, I headed to New York and got to open for Miles Davis at the Village Gate. And Miles looked through me just like Rickles had. But he did something that was as beautiful as his music. Miles knew I was looking for a way to fall off the planet's edge, getting high and wanting more. So one night, as I sat drinking in my dressing room, the MC comes in right before curtain and tells me Miles changed the lineup. I thought I was fired, man. But Miles decided that he was gonna open for me. Do you know what a bad motherfucker you gotta be to have Miles Davis open for you? That's like God, Jack. So I go out on stage, and as I'm about to go into my best Bill Cosby impression, I see this old man with cold-colored skin sitting on the edge of the stage. He's looking at me like, well, boy, let's see what you got. I don't want to hear none of that Bill Cosby shit either. And he said, tell them about Badass Oil Well, about the wino, or about Miss Rudolph the Hoodoo Lady, how she had one titty that had an eye tattooed on it and another that had a mouth, and how when that one titty blew a kiss and the other winked, you knew for the first time you had smoked enough of that shit. I asked the old man his name, and he said, they call me Mudbone. I was born in Tupelo, Mississippi. I looked at him sideways, and he said, that's a city, boy. I was born there a long time ago. So long ago, it ain't worth remembering when exactly, because after a while, it's just a long time ago. Like me, I could tell he died many times and had some stories to tell. You don't live this long being a fool. There's a whole lot of wise young men deader than a motherfucker, he said. Yes, I thought, my meditations on death keep me alive, too. Death would show up from time to time like a distant relative who thought I had been away too long. The funny thing is, I spent years searching, laughing on the tip of a needle, crying between a woman's legs, imitating other people's work, just to come back to a man who had been there all along saying, hey, look over here at me. But I had ignored him, thinking he didn't have anything to say. So I stood there with a cigarette throbbing in one hand and a microphone rocking in the other, and I told them about the fallen angels of my life. And I grabbed a handful of the glow from the spotlights, rubbed it all over my body, right on stage, naked in front of everybody. And I smiled, and they smiled back as the light growing brighter now from the rafters turned to sunshine. Thank you.
I've been listening to the various descriptions of Carol as an editor, and I think she's a great editor. As I was hearing these things, I was trying to figure if I could reduce it all to one sentence or one metaphor that would dramatize what it is that Carol does as an editor. And it finally came to me. And I think I'll even tell you. Carol is a jockey. She's almost short enough to be a jockey. And thin enough. And she lets the horse go at its own sweet will. And she applies the spurs very, very gently and very, very seldom. And that, to me, seems to be the key to her immense success as a jockey and as an editor. I don't know if that's true or not, but I kind of like the idea. Carol and I go back a long way, maybe not quite as long as she and Stephen go, because Stephen's much older than us. I think, like many of us do, Ellen and Steve and the others, of Carol as a dear friend. And I remember so many things. I remember being in a clothing store with Carol years ago at an AWP conference in Florida where she was urging me to buy some new clothes. I remember by accident meeting her on a train once. I'm remembering the various festivals, Bread Loaf, Aspen, and so on, that I've been with her and she with me, the restaurants we've gone to, a special relationship we had, her close help to me when I was under the weather for a couple of years, deeply under the weather, and I tried to pay a little bit in kind to Carol when she was under the weather for a little bit. We had the same illness. It was called darkness. All right, I'm going to read a short poem, so I can almost take any poem at all, but I want to read a recent one, if I may. This is called Asphodel, which was the flower of the dead in Greece, much as the poppy was our flower, and that we saw veterans from time to time selling outside of banks, shopping centers and such, to celebrate Memorial Day, or as they say in the South, Decoration Day. And I wrote the poem memory of a veteran I met on a train in Washington, D.C., when they were changing engines, and suddenly there were three veterans together. This guy from Korea, me from the Biggie, and another guy from Vietnam, Asphodel. He was dead, so he was only a puff of smoke at the most, and I had to labor to see him or just to hear. And when we spoke, it was as if we were waiting in the rain together or in a shelter on 96th Street or by the side of a train in Washington, D.C., say, changing engines and patting each other's stomachs by way of intimacy. And he said what he wanted most of all when it came to trains was merely to stand on the platform looking out the dirty window at the water beyond the row of houses or the stand of trees, for it was distance he loved now and the smell of the ocean even more than coffee. But it was only concoction, for he didn't have the senses anymore. And I forgot to say that he was a veteran, and he wore a green cap that had Korea veteran printed on the face with three bright battle ribbons below the lettering. And I forgot to say his ears were large, the way it sometimes happens in older men, though he was dead. And he was on the train with his wife, who had red hair of sorts and a dress that spread out like a tassel of silk. And war was what we talked about, and what the flowers were, the way a poppy was the emblem of World War I. And we both laughed at how there were no flowers for Korea, nor any poems for that matter. Though he was sad, and although he wore the hat, he said it was a stupid, useless war, unlike Achilles, Odysseus talked to in hell, who loved his war and treasured the noses he severed and the livers he ruptured. And picture them selling their asphodel in front of a supermarket or a neighborhood bank. And picture us waiting until our ears were long just to hate just one of their dumb butcheries. Thank you.
I was the second one after Stephen, and I sort of got to Carol through the back door because I was already at Norton after my third book came out. That was the second book I had done at Norton. I lost my editor there, John Benedict, and I had met Carol through AWP. We were on the board together. And so I tried to wait what I thought was a respectful amount of time before I called her and threw myself at her feet and said, please, please, will you take me on it? I think a lot of what Carol has done, certainly for me, and I know for a lot of other people in this room, has been to be an enabler. And I can speak of that specifically about a book that I did with Carol that came about because of Carol. I simply would not have written a whole book about what seemed to me a dreadful subject, which was the epidemic of 1918-1919, and people were coughing and dying, or coughing and getting well. And I had written a little sequence of these poems, about eight of them, and read some of them at Red Loaf. And Carol, in her sneaky little way, every time we talked on the phone, she would say, how are those flu poems coming along? Why don't you write some more of those flu poems? And I kept saying I didn't think it was possible. She thought it was possible long before I did. So that book, Kyrie, really is a product of her imagination running ahead of mine. And knowing when to encourage, knowing when to say, why not? So I thought I'd just read you a couple of the Kyrie sonnets. They're all very short. And essentially, they're imagined speakers who might have survived the epidemic. To be brought from the bright schoolyard into the house, to stand by her bed like an animal stunned in the pen, against the grid of the quilt, her hand seems stitched to the cuff of its sleeve. Although he wants most urgently the hand to stroke his head, although he thinks he could kneel down, that it would need to travel only inches to brush like a breath his flushed cheek, he doesn't stir. All his resolve, all his resources go to watching her, her mouth, her hair a pillow of blackened ferns. He means to match her stillness bone for bone. Nearby, he hears the younger children cry and his aunts like careless thieves out in the kitchen. This is the double bed where she'd been born, bed of her mother's marriage and decline, bed her sisters also ripened in, bed that drew her husband to her side, bed of her one child lost and five delivered, bed indifferent to the many bodies, bed around which all of them were gathered, watery shapes in the shadows of the room, and the bed frail abroad the violent ocean, the frightened beast so clumsy and pathetic, heaving their wet breath against her neck. She threw off the pile of quilts, white face like a moon, and then entered straightway into heaven. The barber, the teacher, the plumber, the preacher, the man in a bowler, man in a cap, the banker, the baker, the cabinet maker, the fireman, postman, clerk in the shop, soldier and sailor, teamster and tailor, man shoveling snow or sweeping his step, carpenter, cobbler, liar, lawyer, laid them down and never got up. Oh, oh, the world wouldn't stop. The neighborhood grocer, the neighborhood cop, laid them down and never did rise. And some of their children and some of their wives fell into bed and never got up. Fell into bed and never got up. It seems like a fairly short period of time that Carol went from having only two poets, having more poets than anybody else. More than four, I think. I remember counting one time, and you had something like 21. Unbelievable sort of number of poets. Poets have a tremendous variety of voices. Some of that you've heard up here. I wanted to read just two little poems, one each, by two wonderful poets who were Carol's poets and are no longer on the planet. And I think if they were on the planet, they would be right up here with us. So the first one is a poem by Aga Shaid Ali. And it's a poem called Stationary. Stationary. The moon did not become the sun. It just fell on the desert in great sheets, reams of silver handmade by you. The night is your cottage industry now. The day is your brisk emporium. The world is full of paper. Write to me. And this is a short little poem by Stanley Kunitz called The Quarrel. The word I spoke in anger weighs less than a parsley seed, but a road runs through it that leads to my grave, that bought and paid for lot on a salt-sprayed hill in Truro, where the scrub pines overlook the bay. Halfway, I'm dead enough, strayed from my own nature and my fierce hold on life. If I could cry, I'd cry, but I'm too old to be anybody's child. Liefchen, with whom should I quarrel except in the hiss of love, that harsh, irregular flame? And now I think we can all stand up and welcome Carol to the podium.
When this somehow evolved and somebody called me up and said, would I like to do such a thing? At first I thought, oh no, I was embarrassed. And then I thought, well, this might be fun. And then the next thing I thought is, will anybody come? And that has certainly, this is a wonderful afternoon. We ended up with Stanley Kunitz. And as you know, Stanley saw his 100th birthday. I used to call him my Dalai Lama because when I went to see him, he was always present. He was so very, very present. You were the only person that he wanted to talk to at that time. And you tended to think that you were something very, very special. I remember one time, I used to sit on a little Victorian chair by his armchair. And we were talking, and he had these great, big, brown eyes. And he would lean toward me, and we held hands. And he would lean toward me, and one time he said, you're cute. And I thought he was going to say something, you know, poetic. And so I couldn't think of anything to say, and I said, so are you. So I wish he were here, but in a sense he is, because of all the people who appreciated him. And Shahid, of course, was a blithe, a free spirit, and a wonderful dancer. And he was a great cook, and he was a wonderful, wonderful friend. And we went to a place called Chamayo together, which, you know, where people would put their canes and crutches and things on the wall. And then there was a little hole where the sacred soil was. And Shahid had a little empty jar of Nescafe, and he gave me a little coffee thing of the Chamayo soil, and I think I still have it. I understand they replace the soil every day. Maybe they still do. People have mentioned AWP, and so many of these people we've met at various times in AWP, and I was writing down something about the people who were here. And Stephen said, I'm doing them the way they talk to you. We met in Utah at the Writers at Work conference. I heard him read, and then I was addressing a group of students after reading manuscripts and all. And then I was speaking to them, and I said, you know, he knows how to write about men and women and human relationships of that sort. So we've already covered that. So we happened to meet in the bookstore after that, and he said, I hear you've been talking about me. And so we talked a little more, and then I knew he was committed to another publisher, but I think it was about 6 months later, something like that, he showed up in my office in a blue shirt and a plaid jacket, I remember that. And we talked, and he wanted to know if I wanted to publish his poetry. And at that time, I wasn't doing poetry. So I went to John Benedict, and I said, what do you think of this? And I was ready to hand it over to him, and he said, Carol, you can publish poetry as well as anybody else. So then he called Alan Bryant Boyd, who gave him a vote of confidence. You see how these things are all incestuous. So we published Stephen. What he did for me was to give me the confidence to publish poetry. And I found it a wonderful mix along with fiction. I mean, both these things nourished each other. So it's a blended combination. And we have seen each other through these years and through his winning of the Pulitzer Prize, which was a great joy. So, on to the next one. I really met Beth Ann Fennelly through her husband, Tom Franklin, who had been an admirer of my writer, Rick Bass. And then I met Beth Ann. You invited me to the Oxford Conference on the Book, and I went to Oxford, Mississippi. And Beth Ann read, first time I heard her read, and she read to a group that was as large as this. It was packed. I swear, you sat on a little bar stool, and there was some music. It was a bluegrass band or something like that, and it was stunning, and it was so natural, and it was this kind of barn-like place. I said to myself, I really want to publish this poet. So it came to pass. Her first book with Norton was called Tenderhooks, and it was largely about first-time motherhood. And these poems were very frank and very noteworthy. And one of my colleagues, also a mother, said, she dares to write about things we don't talk about. And that was true, or perhaps it was and perhaps it wasn't. But anyway, her next book is called Unmentionables, and it's about things, being frank about things, but also the things that we care so much about that we don't get the words for them. Now Van I met through Ellen. Ellen kept saying, you've got to read his poetry. My memory is that we officially met in the lobby of that New Orleans AWP, that miserable Radisson. I mean, everybody became so cohesive because the rooms leaked and it was just a perfectly dreadful place. But I think that we met then. And then Ellen had said, you're going to like his poetry. He tells stories. It's narrative. And so then he came to Norton, and both you and your book, Magnolia, was greeted with the highest enthusiasm. And what I loved was the combination of history, of film, his poetry is very cinematic, and of jazz, the blues. Then we came to quantum lyrics, and I thought, ooh, I don't know anything about physics. But as it turned out, you taught me a little about physics, and you taught me a little more about superheroes, too. And I remember you gave both me and my assistant a great big thing of stamps that had superheroes on it. And that was a very nice thing to do. It seems to me that any time you call to tell Van he's won something, he's not sure whether that is good or not, you know? And I remember when I said you won a Whiting, and you kind of paused, and you weren't particularly enthusiastic, and I said, this is a very good thing to have. Jerry, you and I have been so many places. One that came to mind was the AWP in Miami. We went to eat Cuban food, and then you drove me all around, and we went all along South Beach. And you told me the stories from your childhood and about your mother. And we had this whole history of those marvelous hotels from the very beginning up to the modern ones. And we had a way always of just kind of strolling around the way you do in your poetry, you know? That wasn't necessary to get any place in a hurry. We were also at Aspen together. I think that's where we actually met. And we've been to a number of AWPs, and we've been to Prague. One of my most exciting nights was when you won the National Book Award, and everybody feted you. Now, I guess the last thing in the collection that we're going to do next, Save the Last Dance, there's a long poem. It was 34 pages in manuscript, and it's called The Preacher. And it's Jerry's take on Ecclesiastes. Well, this took me back to the Bible. I mean, here's another thing you learn from the writers, and I have begun delving more into the Bible and enjoying that. Telephone calls with Jerry are very interesting. Sometimes he sings to me, Red Sails in the Sunset. Anyway, Jerry, Save the Last Dance for me. Ellen came to me through another editor who had left. And I remember we were both on the board of AWP, and I don't remember that you were all diffident, but I do remember that the director of AWP at that time said, Ellen has the mind of a Jesuit. Ellen is somebody that you go to when you want advice, and she listens, and her advice is always sage. I stayed at Ellen's house in Vermont. When I look out the window, I can see these cows that seem to have a very happy life. But then I remember the poem about the farmer and his son coming and pushing them into the little trailer that is going to take them off to another place. I feel as if I know a lot of the places in your poems. About Kyrie, part of that came about because we were talking about fever. And I said to you, I remember when I had scarlet fever when I was in the fourth grade, and the house had a quarantine sign on it, and my mother brought me my meals upstairs. I did not go to the hospital. And my father came and stood in the doorway sometimes just to say hello to me, and that was about 6 weeks. And I remember telling you that story, and it went in one of the stanzas. Somebody quarantined like that. I've had a wonderful time with all these people, and I see some other people I dearly love in the audience. And thank you very much.